Welcome to EAN Cast, your weekly source for education, research, and updates from the European Academy of Neurology.
Hello, and welcome to the EAN Cast Weekly Neurology. My name is Andrew Vilaseca, presenter of the podcast today. I'm a European junior neurologist doing a research fellowship about autoimmune neurology in the Mayo Clinic, Rochester, Minnesota. This month's topic is neuroimmunology, and today's episode will talk about Susak syndrome. Before we dive into the topic, let me introduce who is joining us today. Here we have the privilege of discussing this disease with two expert neurologists, each offering a unique perspective, the vascular and the immunological. My guests today are Professor Barbara Villekens, who is neurologist and researcher at Antwerp University Hospital and University of Antwerp, Belgium, focusing on common and rare neuroimmunological disorders of the central nervous system, and Professor Ilka Kleffner, who is neurologist at Nachtschattenklinikum University Hospital in Bochum, Germany, focusing on neurovascular diseases and research in Susak syndrome. Welcome, and thank you all for joining us today. So, Susak syndrome was likely first described by Robert Hollandhurst and David Pfaffenbach from Mayo Clinic in 1973. They identified the condition in two patients with suspected multifocal retinal artery occlusions, who also had similar involvement in the CNS, without an embolic source. Later, in 1979, John Susak published two additional cases, suggesting a vasculitic etiology that could respond to steroids. He also noted ear involvement, which along with the brain and eye symptoms led to the development of the classic triad, brain, eye, ear, that many neurologists now associate with the syndrome. So the first question is here is like mandatory. How often do you think these three symptoms present together at clinical onset, and which of the three is typically the most significant in leading the diagnosis? So maybe Professor Ilka Kleffner, if you want to start.
Yeah, thank you very much for the invitation and thank you much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here and thank you very much for this question. Yes, it sounds so easy that there's a clinical triad of three symptoms of branch retinal artery occlusions, encephalopathy and hearing loss. But usually you only have one or two of the triad altogether in the beginning. And most likely it's not the complete triad, only in 10 to 30% you have the complete triad at presentation. In many patients, the CNS symptoms, the encephalopathy is the first symptom of the disease and often with prodromal headache, and it can be up to 6 months in advance.
Okay, very, very interesting. Another question related to the misdiagnosis, Professor Villekens. Which diagnosis is most frequently misdiagnosed in patients with Susak syndrome? Could you share an example of a specific patient you've treated who was initially misdiagnosed?
Yeah, misdiagnosis is something we see in several patients. And especially, I think, because Susak syndrome is quite a rare disease. And if you have never seen a certain patient with the disease, then it's sometimes difficult to recognize it. And I'm quite sure that when I was a resident, I must have missed a case of Susak syndrome. In cohorts, we see that one of the most frequent misdiagnoses is multiple sclerosis. And that probably has to do with the fact that several symptoms can appear similar and that there are lesions in the corpus callosum, although the aspect is definitely different in MS and in Susak syndrome. Other misdiagnoses depend also a little bit on the presentation. For instance, if you have a patient presenting with symptoms relating to the hearing loss or vestibular symptoms, it can sometimes look a little bit like Meniere syndrome, and it can be misdiagnosed like that in the beginning. Of course, when you have branch retinal artery occlusions, all other types of vasculitis come always into place and into the differential diagnosis, and having to look further. But in general, I believe, and maybe Ilka Klevner, you can also comment on that. I think the MRI patterns that we see in TUSAC patients are really often different from people with MS.
Yeah, that's completely true. And I think if you have a little experience and if you're aware of these rare differential diagnoses, you will be able to see the difference between other encephalitis and Susac syndrome and MS. I just wanted to add another unfortunate patient with a misdiagnosis because you asked for an example. I had a patient and she was misdiagnosed as schizophrenic paranoia, and she spent 6 months in a psychiatric hospital. She did not get an MRI, and only after 6 months she got an MRI, and then they saw the lesions. So I think even if in these patients, you should be aware of something like Susac syndrome, because the psychiatric and cognitive symptoms can be very prominent in these patients. And maybe they even don't talk about hearing loss or visual problems.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, if I can add to that indeed an example that you asked, I also thinking of one of our patients who initially presented with some migraineous headaches, but also some intermittent sensory symptoms in the right hand. She received an MRI. It showed indeed one callosal lesion, and she had a couple of smaller supratentorial lesions, but nothing really specific or completely specific for one or the other disease. And it went away by itself, and she recovered, and she had a lumbar puncture. There were no oligoclonal bands, no cells, normal protein. And since everything went away, the patient was just followed up, and nothing happened for another year. And then she represented again with encephalopathic symptoms and cognitive changes, attention symptoms, and she developed also branch retinal artery occlusion with vision loss. And in the beginning, I think in this patient, it was suspected that she had a clinically isolated syndrome.
Thank you very much for sharing these clinical cases. Following on that, for example, in your experience, what is the most common clinical course of the disease if left untreated?
Do you dare to not treat a patient with Susac syndrome? I would really ask a question back, because I would not dare to not treat a patient with Susac syndrome. I think that's very relevant. Even the case that I discussed was a relatively mild presentation in the beginning, looking back, and the patient was not at all treated for that, and then the symptoms went away and it came back. And I know a couple of other cases where it went in, where the disease course was a bit in a similar way. Patients had a relatively minor symptom, it wasn't recognized, and then they were stable for quite some time, and then the disease really came back in a more severe way. Does this mean that you do not have to treat from the beginning? No, not at all. I think you should treat Susac syndrome always, because it can have very, very severe consequences. Patients can remain severely cognitively affected if they are not treated. Well, what's your experience, Ilka, and what's your take on this?
Yes, I see it exactly like you. One should treat those patients because of the severe cognitive and neurological deficits the patients can have. And the good thing is, even if you misdiagnose these patients in the beginning, you often have a diagnosis that leads to some kind of polypragmatic treatment, including immunosuppression, maybe even IVIG. Even if you have a patient with a very severe encephalopathy in the beginning, you have no diagnosis yet, you will treat him or her with a variety of drugs, and steroids are a very fast working treatment against the activity of Susak syndrome. Yes, I would definitely treat my patient. Yeah.
Thank you very much. Let's move on the diagnostic tests. So beyond many of the central or fully transverse callosal lesions typically described, what other clues can be found in the diagnostic tests? Maybe Professor Wilkens, you want to start?
Mm-hmm. Well, maybe because you started with some MRI features, I think we could continue with the MRI features that we see in patients with Susak syndrome, and that can help us differentiate them also from MS or other neuroimmunological CNS diseases. So indeed, very typical, you have the centrally located callosal lesions that are also called snowball lesions. They can sometimes also develop into a black hole in within the corpus callosum. And while in MS, the callosal lesions are more to the callosoceptal interface, in Susak syndrome, they are more located either centrally or on the roof of the corpus callosum. And when you have lesions coming from the roof, they call it icicles, icicles. And snowballs. I actually quite like this analogy. It's also very easy to remember. Other typical things are that you can see a variety of number of lesions, I would say, outspread throughout the brain. So they can be present in the periventricular, the subcortical white matter, but also you can see cortical lesions and also lesions in the posterior fossa. In general, the lesions are smaller than what you see in MS. Sometimes they are more punctate, and there can be many, many lesions that are diffusion restrictive at the same time. You can also see quite a typical leptomeningeal enhancement, and very typical in the cerebellar folia, you can see this leptomeningeal enhancement, although you can also see it supratentorally. This contrast enhancement is often very punctate in my experience, and not as you can see in MS, that it's an open ring enhancement. That's a different pattern of enhancement that you can see. And then there are also a couple of typical things that you can see on fluoangiogram, but maybe Professor Kleffner would like to comment on the typical findings that you can see there.
Exactly, the non-radiological part of the diagnostic test.
I just wanted to add for the MRI features. It's very interesting in contrast to MS. In MS, you typically have a central vein in the lesions. And this is not the fact in Susak syndrome. So if you compare, for example, with a 7 Tesla MRI or even a 3 Tesla MRI, then you will not find a vessel inside of the lesion. But concerning vessel occlusions, I think still the best test for looking at vessels directly is for a scene angiography of the eye. And there you can directly see the occlusions of the branchiotary arteries. Usually the veins here are also not affected. In contrast to emboli, you will find the occlusion in the middle of the vessel and not at the bifurcation. They are often in the periphery of the central artery and not in the main central artery, but in a branch or multiple branches. So you have to instruct your ophthalmologist to look at the periphery of the eye. Another very typical feature is the hypofluorescence of the vessel wall, and this is due to the leakage of the vessels. It's not a complete leakage with a lot of leaking fluorescein, but you see a very bright and fluorescein vessel wall of the affected vessel. And this might be a sign of activity. Yeah. Sometimes when you look at these hyperfluorescent branch arteries, you will find an occlusion at the same site 1 week later, for example. It is also very important that you instruct your ophthalmologist to do this examination and not only the perimetry, because of the peripheral lesions, maybe they even don't have a scotoma or any symptoms. Yeah, some patients describe scintillating scotomata, but many patients, especially when they are encephalopathic, they don't have any symptoms at all. Another very important and non-invasive technique is OCT, and you will find typical reduction of certain layers on OCT.
But I think in OCT, you will probably mainly see it once there has been a prior occlusion, because it gives retinal degeneration at the site of the occlusion. So that's not an acute measure, but more a proof, I think, that something has happened to the eye and the retina, which can, of course, be very helpful in cases where you are not so sure or who do not have brow at the time of your evaluation with a fluorescein angiogram, but do have other typical features for Susak syndrome. I completely agree with Professor Kleffner that many, many times those brows are asymptomatic and that patients do not always notice the abnormalities either due to the periphery or also due to, I don't know, maybe good compensation and then good collateral flows, but they definitely don't always notice it. So it's a very important investigation to always do and to stress. It's like when you think of meningitis, always do an LP. In Susak, it's when you think of Susak, always do a fluorescein angiogram.
It's a good sentence to summarize the diagnostic part. Yeah. And for example, if you are going to the third part of the triad, how do we study the ear component?
Patients get sent to the ENT specialist and there's an audiogram performed. I think it's also important to always do it, especially because if there is only a mild hearing loss in one ear, patients also don't tend to always notice it. I've seen that a couple of times that you can find mild hearing loss when patients don't notice it. They only notice it when it's already quite severe or bilateral. Well, what's your experience, Ilka?
Yeah, I made the same experience. They often do not recognize their hearing loss, but sometimes hearing loss can also be very severe and they go to bed like a normal person and they wake up without hearing on one ear. So it's an overnight hearing loss. And what you can see on the audiogram is typically, but not exclusively, a hearing loss for the low frequencies. And this is also an explanation why they have not high note tinnitus, but a roaring tinnitus with some kind of deep frequencies and low frequencies tinnitus.
Okay, so we have our patient diagnosed. So let's move on to the therapeutic part. We have discussed a little bit before, but Susak syndrome is believed to be mediated by CD8 T cells, likely targeting specific vascular antigens. So as a result, immunosuppressive treatment has been the cornerstone of the disease management. Now, I'd like to describe a few patients who could have been diagnosed with Susak syndrome. And I would appreciate your thoughts on the specific treatments you would recommend in this patient. So let's start with Professor Villekens. Here we have a 25-year-old woman with two episodes of retinal arterial occlusion, recently diagnosed with Susak syndrome. So this is the next step in the therapeutic part.
So I think, first of all, the patient has quite a typical age for Susac syndrome, 25 years, and a woman. We see more women than men with Susac syndrome. And then two episodes of retinal artery occlusion. And I would assume then that she has typical abnormalities also on the brain MRI, but no hearing loss now. So then you have actually two out of the three organ systems that are involved. So you have not then a complete diagnosis of Susac syndrome because you miss one of the organ systems. But I think this is really good to illustrate because it's a situation that we all encounter quite frequently, like we said in the beginning, that you do not always have a complete triad. And you should also not wait until the complete triad develops to start a treatment. I think that's a very important message to give. In a 25-year-old, there are, of course, a couple of considerations to take into account. So the severity of the disease is important, but also in a 25-year-old, I mean, this is still a woman of a childbearing age who may have a child wish in the future. And we also know that women with Susac syndrome tend to have less frequently a monophasic course than the men, unfortunately. So in my experience, women need to be treated often longer time or have more chance of a relapse than the men. But I mean, I don't have a huge experience due to the fact that it's a rare disease, but I think it's also seen in the reviews and in the literature. So you should choose a treatment that could be compatible potentially with future pregnancy wish. And of course, it should be weighed. And you should also look into what are the possibilities in your specific country, because not everything is easily available everywhere. So the mainstay of the treatment is steroids. We always start with a high dose course of IV steroids when there are acute symptoms. So I would consider that this patient has had a very recent visual symptom, and then that was the reason to diagnose the patient with Susac syndrome. So she would be treated with steroids IV and then a slow oral tapering schedule over many, many weeks and months. Yeah. And then we also add another treatment, corticoid sparing agent. In this case of a young woman, my preference would be to start IVIG, but it's not always possible. At least in Belgium, it's really, really difficult to get IVIG reimbursed. So in the acute phase, you can then also opt in severe cases for plasma exchange. That works quite well as well. But if a patient is not severely encephalopathic and has only a small brow, then I think that's kind of invasive therapy to start. So I would not do that immediately. And in this case, you could consider to add rituximab as a treatment or azathioprine as a corticoid sparing agent. Mycophenolate tends to work also quite well, but that's not so good compatible with a pregnancy wish. So it's something that needs to be discussed really well with the patient as well. So that would be my first steps for this patient, and then some frequent monitoring.
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much. And the second patient, Professor Kleffner. So here we have a 35-year-old woman diagnosed with Susac syndrome 2 years ago following a retinal artery occlusion and hypocrisia. She was treated with steroids and monthly IVIG. Now, encephalopathy and new CNS lesions have emerged. What is the next step in her treatment? What would you recommend?
Yeah, thank you very much. Yeah, I think this is quite uncommon, but it's possible that the severe encephalopathy comes after the first artery occlusions, but it's possible. And if you have excluded any other differential diagnosis and she has a relapse with steroids and monthly IVIG, I would first ask if the steroids have been high enough or if she was in the tapering episode. Because in my experience, while tapering down steroids, you often have a relapse or even a severe relapse or emerging CNS ear or eye problem. So I would probably start with another IV metoprednisolone course and continue the IVIG and then add a fast-working, as fast as possible, working immunotreatment. Here in this case, I think I would choose rituximab, infliximab, or natalizumab. If this does not work and if steroids have been high enough in the beginning, I could also think of plasma exchange in this patient combined with steroids.
Okay, so very nice treatment for huge treatments here for these severe patients, indeed. So, and the last question after the treatment has been started, and apart from the clinical response, what is the best complementary test to monitor treatment response, in your opinion?
Maybe to get back to the treatment, I think it's something we forgot to mention, that there is no evidence-based treatment paradigm. In Susak syndrome, there are no clinical trials that tell us which treatment is the best to give to the patient. And it's all based on expert opinion, on a case series. So we actually don't know what is the best to do. And we mainly base the treatment also based on how other immune-mediated disorders are treated. But it's not really specific for Susak syndrome. And you tend to give a more severe or more heavy treatment to patients who are more severely affected because, of course, of the benefit-risk ratio of the treatments. So I think it's really important that in the future we will try to combine and to join efforts and to know more about what will be the best way to treat our patients. So then maybe for your last question, how do you monitor treatment response? I think it's also a very difficult question and a question that also deserves some additional research. I think you need MRI to monitor the treatment response and fluoangiograms quite frequently. And in patients who have presented with hearing loss, you also need sometimes to monitor the hearing. But I tend to do that less frequently than the other additional examinations because once a patient is treated, it's very rare to detect then a hearing loss that the patient did not notice him or herself as a monitoring strategy. So if there are any symptoms or if there's any doubt, we do another audiogram, but it's not a test that I use to monitor very regularly. Fluangiograms, I tend to do them especially in the beginning, after 2 months, 3 months. We tend to do this very regularly when the patient is still in an active phase, even after 1 month in the beginning. So it's a very important examination to follow the patients. What do you think, Professor Kleffner?
Yeah, it's exactly the same. I tend to do less and less audiograms, and my favorite monitoring tool is fluorescein angiography, especially in the beginning, and of course frequent MRIs, because sometimes many patients have continuous headache, and they continue to have headache. Sometimes they say, today my headache's worse, and you don't know if it's a relapse or if it's just some natural fluctuation. So I do repeated MRIs in these patients to monitor the treatment. And of course, clinical neurological examination.
It's have the ophthalmology and the radiology very close to us following these patients. Okay.
Absolutely.
So thank you very much for your opinions on that. And before we wrap up, I'd like to ask you to summarize the disease in just 1 minute. I know that it's difficult, but in 1 minute, if you want, Professor Klefner, we want to start with the clinical aspects and pathophysiology, maybe.
I will try to make it short. Well, Susak syndrome is a very rare autoimmune disease, and it's affecting predominantly young women. It is characterized by a clinical triad of encephalopathy, sensory neural hearing loss, and branch retinal artery occlusions. The encephalopathy may be very severe and lead to cognitive deficits and psychiatric symptoms, focal neurological symptoms, headache, and visual disturbance, even to coma. Hearing loss often emerges suddenly, for example, overnight, and branch retinal artery occlusions are often asymptomatic, but may lead to scintillating scotomata and may be only seen in the examinations. We did not talk about CSF yet, but now I will do it. And CSF shows protein elevation and brain CSF barrier disturbance. And the MRI shows typically small periventricular and the typical collosal snowball lesions, sometimes leptomeningeal enhancement or DWI lesions. These the typical features help to distinguish Susak syndrome from encephalitis of MS is this leptomeningeal enhancement. Susak syndrome is an autoimmune disease mediated by CD8 T cells, and I think this will lead us to the treatment of the disease.
So last thoughts on treatments, Professor Bulikens.
Susak syndrome should definitely be treated with immunosuppressants, but we do not yet know what is the best treatment combination or the treatment duration or which treatments work best for the patients. Steroids are the mainstay of the treatment of Susak syndrome, and often all kinds of immunosuppressants can be added. This will depend on the severity of the presentation of the patient, also on the availability of therapies in several countries, and on the experience that there is with certain therapies in the patient by the neurologist. Very often used are IVIG, rituximab, mycophenolate, and TNF-alpha inhibitors.
So thank you so much for joining us today. We've learned a great deal about neuroimmunology. So another episode of EAN Cast will be coming out next week, and we hope you won't miss it. So have a great day.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
This has been EAN Cast Weekly Neurology. Thank you for listening. Be sure to follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your preferred podcatcher for weekly updates from the European Academy of Neurology. You can also listen to this and all of our previous episodes on the EAN campus to gain points and become an EAN expert in any of our 29 neurological specialties. Simply become an EAN individual member to gain access. For more information, visit ean.org/membership. That's ean.org/membership. Thanks for listening. EAN Cast Weekly Neurology is your unbiased and independent source for educational and research-related neurological content. Although all content is provided by experts in their field, it should not be considered official medical advice.